Welcome to Soundscapes, a Terrain.org podcast. Today we explore what it means to be more than alone, and how each individual, embedded in complex systems, both ecological and otherwise, experiences this differently. We'll begin with Erin Block reading her recent essay, Solo, which is, well, I'll let you decide.
This is Erin Block reading the essay, Solo. There's a particular curve along this dirt road that climbs and climbs, where you can tell if it's going to be windy, and it almost always is. Especially now, mid-November, when everything along the Front Range howls. But the yellow curvy arrow signs that line the road seem redundant. No one's going fast. Everyone's just climbing. Up to dawn. To morning. I think about the year my sister got a t-shirt for her birthday that had an embossed barrel racer on the front, her ponytail flying out behind her cowboy hat with the words, "Dangerous curves ahead," printed at the top on the front of the tee. My grandmother said to my mother, "Do you really think that's appropriate?" I didn't understand at the time, but I knew it was something about a woman's body. Something about us. My mother said, "She's only 9. My mother said, "It's just about a horse." The sun's rising and streaming through lodge poles, the way you think a diamond will shine, until you see one sitting all dull on a lady older than you's hand, and you realize you never wanted one of those in the first place. You just wanted to hold fire, light, warmth, a heart in your hands. I got a flat from this road last year, but it's such a washboard I didn't realize it until I got back on the hardball and my stomach sunk. I'd never changed a tire. There was always someone, some male along with. A father you could call, a man who came to the rescue, a dad, boyfriend, husband, a stranger who we somehow felt comfortable with because they'd stopped to help, because that meant they were a good person and not a strangler who'd put you in a septic tank on their 1,000-acre farm. Now I wonder why the women I knew, the strong women who raised me, never changed their own flats. Why, even as I was brought up at the beginning of the girl power movement, was I still, by default, taught to depend on men for unpleasant things? For the dirty, the heavy, the cold. Society doesn't prepare girls to be alone. But I dug out the user's manual from the glove compartment, jacked up the back right, and got on with it. A cow moose walked through a pond down below the roadbed, and I thought, this isn't a bad place to learn something new. I reach the end of the road and park. A gust of wind shakes my truck, my rusty old Ranger, rocking side to side like standing up in a canoe. My body tenses. I hold my breath. I know what this will feel like you know heartbreak will, after the first few red flags. I strap on snowshoes, pulling hard on the plastic straps that have stiffened in the cold, grab my pack and shotgun, and crunch across the parking area. No one else is around. I had plans to hunt a new area I scouted this summer, with a maze of meadows full of scrub willow and sink foil for cover. I was hunting mushrooms, and the day was hot and windy. The kind of day a wildfire kicks up. And I saw the hind end of a hare disappear behind juniper. He was a beautiful light brown then, with the color hair that on women shows gray first and fastest. I circled the area, round and round, and I couldn't find him again, but he made me anxious for winter. Weather dictates direction, and right now, the snowfield between me and the meadows seems too daunting. I stick to what I know and head to a closed Forest Service road that angles northeast, where the wind's not as bad as it could be. There's a fresh inch on top of weeks of snow, layered like tiramisu, the melted and frozen crusts like crumbled cookies. Wind-blown slabs lay upon each other, so when you post-hole, it feels like you're in one of those cartoons where the character falls through a building, floor by floor. Out here in the open, most of the snow has already blown away. A hare could have been here 5 minutes before right now, and its tracks would already be gone, wiped clean. These windy days, like walking up a river in old westerns. Lose tracks, lose scent, stay alive. I should have swung down on the far side of the meadow, because now I have to get there from here, where the wind pushes my 120 pounds back like a hand on a kid's forehead, when they think it's funny and that you're so strong. In Colorado, the snowshoe hare's range is limited to high elevation forests where they feast on conifers. On the Engelmann spruce, lodgepole pine, and subalpine fir that circle meadows like flowers on mountain ball cactus, that are the first wildflower to bloom mid-April when hummingbirds arrive from Mexico and turkeys start gobbling in the canyons. And there's a sweet spot of weeks to hunt hare up here, even though the season goes for months, from October through February. To time it so there's snow for tracks, but not so much you post-hole every step. And I've mistimed this hunt. Waited too long through too many snows. I post-hole to my thighs in places. My ankle tweaks, and I have to pull myself up and out by nearby spruce branches. I think about the snowshoes getting stuck, wonky in the willows, and snapping my knee. I think about a bull moose charging. This is my first time hunting alone, and I'm instantly aware how it changes pace and pressure. Because there is no fallback, no one to depend on other than what you remember of what you have done before. I've always hunted with my partner, Jay. He's taught me how to stalk and track and shoot, how to skin and gut, but before that, to lay on hands like a prayer of thanks, a wish for safe passage, an ask of forgiveness. His experience has so many years on mine that even when I know what to do, I rely on him for reassurance. If I come home empty-handed, if I fail at what I'm out here to do, is it because that's just how things played out? Or is it because of me? Do I even know what I'm doing? Of course, most days afield you come home with a light pack. I know that by now. Most days you do not find success. But it stings a little more when you're a woman and when you're alone. No one's there to corroborate your story, that you did the right things. They just didn't work out this time. Society doesn't prepare girls to be believed. I've had seasons now of knowing how hard these hare are to hunt. Days on days of misses, or seeing nothing at all, of the maddening amount of tracks, of knowing they do not burrow, they're around. That one crush you want to cross paths with over summer break, but never do. We don't hunt with a dog, and it took a while to figure out how to be successful, how to find them and pressure them until they jump, how they like meadow edges and baby spruce, where they sit just how a mushroom would. When we hunt hare together, we take turns playing the beagle. One of us busting through cover, the other walking slower and angled behind, pretending to be ready for one to jump your way. It's slower without a dog to snoot them out, but we've started working well as a team most days, reading body language and hand signals, and never walking single file. And mostly considering getting an eye on one to be a successful day. That's been our rate of success with snowshoes. And alone now, it's different. All the dogging and shooting's up to me, and I don't have an extra pair of eyes. I don't have someone to pull the trigger when I miss. I move slowly to minimize the sound of snowshoes on the crusty snow and keep my eyes scanning, looking for movement, shadows, pattern shapes. An old man told me, just look for the eyes. As they hold tight beneath a baby spruce, those big black marbles will give them away. I've managed this once, last year, but otherwise, it's always been running shots. And I like that. I don't have time to think. Instinct has less emotion attached. I shoulder my grandfather's shotgun. He's dead now. But my grandmother found it in their basement a few years ago and gave it to my dad, who gave it to me, as I was the only one in the family who would use it. It's a .22 .410, over under, for sitting shots or running ones. That's a farm gun, Jay said at the time. That's useful. My dad wondered why he'd kept it, and my grandmother did too. No one knows, so I make up stories. How it was given to him by their farmhand, an Okie who'd take my grandpa hunting for rabbit after evening chores. How they'd sneak out from Sunday services and walk railroad tracks to avoid being seen by anyone who'd be wanting to know why they weren't in church. Grabbing shotguns, they stashed in a culvert. They'd put in pheasant loads, 5-shot. They'd smoke cigarettes. I don't think my grandfather would have considered himself a feminist, and I didn't have the chance to ask. But there's an egalitarianism that comes from growing up on a Great Plains farm during the Depression. I'd like to think he'd be surprised, but not disappointed, that a granddaughter got his gun. I walk on the tops of trees, on tips of the small spruce that start at the edge of the willows. The snow is so deep, I'm feet above where I'd be in the summertime, hunting porcini. I always wonder what it would be like to be taller, what the world would look like at 6'2", what I'd see, what I'd miss, what I'd catch in between. And maybe this is it. Just more trees in my face, up where the branches are thick and there's farther to fall through. Jim Harrison called the songs of unseen birds grace, the courtesy of telling your friends where you're going and when you'll be home. And as I push through deeper into the trees, the wind eases and old tracks appear. I try to quiet myself, but everything quickens. For me, grace has never been calming. A few more steps and there's movement to my side left. I question it like an old memory, walk over to investigate, and the tracks are fresh. I follow up a steep hill counterclockwise. I widen my eyes, feeling that might help, but I just feel buggy and dry. The hare jumps again, farther away this time. My eyes strain and breath thickens with panic of losing him. I walk robotically now, checking before each footfall for tracks, shotgun jammed into my shoulder, left arm ready to lift the barrel, right finger anxious on the safety. And again, 4 times, he sees me first and slips away. until he doesn't, silhouetting himself on the snow between two lodge poles. It's my time now, and I take it. So I'll tell you of the color of snow. You'll understand someday when you see a snowshoe hare, when you hunt one and jump one and see it vanish like your breath in a headlamp beam on a winter's night, as you purse and blow and pretend like you're smoking. When you see one laid out with sun and shadow moving through trees, like you're staring at the bottom of a freestone creek, squinting hard to make out the green dappled backs of cutthroat trout. Do you remember as a kid trying to find a use for the white crayon? It was always the longest, sharpest, the most unused, because white doesn't really exist. It's a reflection and scatter. It is snow, which is fur, which is brown, which is blood, which will all wash away in the end. It's absence, the color leaving my hair, the pigment dying and moving to age spots on my face instead. It's one of the first colors we used to paint with on the cave walls of Lascaux. Calcite used to highlight horses, bison, and lions drawn in charcoal from fires that kept us warm, that gave us sight. White's all around me, and when I look down, I can't believe my eyes. The color of snow, the hair, the grief set hard in. And now I remember what to do, how to slit around the back legs and pull off the skin like a sweater, how to cut ribs to hip and pull the insides out, how to take care with the bloodshot, how it feels to hold a heart in my hand. 5 p.m., back at home, and the cabin glows. How I imagine it must feel being backstage after a play, when the curtain is drawn, but house lights turn on and everyone claps. For you, for the job you've done, hopefully well. In the mountains, you have to pay for a view. To be up high, looking east for a new day, or west over the divide. But my cabin nestles low in a canyon, where the cold hangs well into midday and snowbanks swallow the raspberry canes whole. Down at the end of a draw, where cattle once pulled carts full of ice from a pond above to towns below. I found their shoes, just like for horses, but in two parts, the luck all let out for their cloven hooves. And when I look around or up, all I see are trees, pointed pines jagged like teeth in a dinosaur jawbone, bleaching in the sun and the sand. I step out to the back porch and look west, the whole of sky above me filled with orange, in big, confident strokes.
Erin was kind enough to make time to sit down and talk to me about her essay. I hope you enjoy listening in on our conversation about why going solo matters, the questionable perks of being a tomboy, and about what it's like to literally hold a heart in your hand. Erin Black, thank you for joining us today and for sharing your reading of Solo. It's a probing essay. It stuck with me since I first read it, and I'm really excited to be able to connect with you.
Thanks for having me on.
So I noticed that the title of your piece, Solo, it echoes a sentence that stuck out to me in the essay. You wrote, "Society doesn't prepare girls to be alone." I was wondering if you could say a little more about what that means to you.
Yeah, I think growing up, you're always taught to go places in groups. And I remember my mom telling my sister and I, once we started driving and we could go off by ourselves, if you're walking alone, to always carry your keys between your fingers and all of these kind of self-defense mechanisms that really we're not unwarranted. Like, there's very real concerns. But at the same time, I think it kind of imprinted on my mind this real fear of going solo places, driving somewhere by myself, going on hikes by myself, just not being alone, because I'm kind of a loner naturally, but just kind of this fear of like, what all these bad things can happen. And then at the same time, there was kind of this cultural, but when bad things happen, a man will come save you. That whole kind of like damsel in distress.
Right.
You don't have to deal with the messy things, you know. And then I think when I got into my early 20s, and I had a very early marriage and divorce, and I was like an adult woman all by myself and had to deal with things that I wasn't like prepared to deal with. Just simple things like, oh, I guess I have to pay attention to oil changes and car maintenance. And I bought a house by myself, which was very eye-opening. I remember when I called the realtor for a showing, he was like, well, is this time good for your husband? And I had not even mentioned a husband. And I was like, well, it's just expected that a woman wouldn't be doing this by herself. So yeah, I think there was just this cultural thing that I was brought up with.
And it's really interesting that you make this distinction between being alone and being solo. That's something I was thinking about as I read the essay too, and thinking about that we've been living for almost 2 years now in this global pandemic, where I would venture to say almost everyone has spent more time alone. But it sounds like that's not really what you're talking about. Solo is different.
That's a very interesting distinction. Yeah, it's like solo is more alone than alone. I like being alone, and I think I have a lot more confidence doing things solo. But there is like a almost like some sort of echo to the word solo, where you're totally alone. You know, there's like almost a void to being solo or something. Where if you're just alone, you're by yourself, but you're not solo. Yeah, that's a great observation.
But you might not have anything particularly difficult to do when you're alone. It seems like maybe solo is really connected with having to confront challenges by yourself.
Yeah, I would say you're right there. Alone almost has like a peaceful connotation to me. Like, you can be alone, you know, meditating or reading or just being outside. But solo does have like a almost like a goal sound to it.
If it is a goal, solo, what would you say? What do we all have, and you personally, to gain from this kind of solitude?
I think it's a lot of confidence and not being dependent on someone else. I guess a level of almost responsibility too, which kind of ties back into why I started hunting in the first place. Because there is this sense of, if you're solo, you really can't be dependent on anyone else. And you have to make sure you have all of your I's dotted and T's crossed, and you know where you're going. You have the maps and you have water. And there's, I think, a lot of responsibility that's connected to that word in my head. And yeah, there's just a lot of confidence that can come from it. I suppose there's also a lot of disaster and bad ends that can come from that as well. But I think that's why I suppose it's a little bit of a high, you know, when I have been solo doing things and have success, whether or not that's hunting or summiting a peak or whatever. There's a real, I don't know, kind of emotional high that you get when you've kind of completed your task.
It is special. You mentioned this confidence, empowerment almost, and I was also wondering, maybe with relation to that, you could elaborate on the connection between feminism and owning a gun that you briefly consider in Solo with respect to your grandfather.
Yeah, that is something that I've just, you know, since hunting really started to think about. And kind of his gun was, I was not raised with firearms at all. I was raised on a farm, so I was raised with animals, and even, you know, raising animals for me, the whole butchering process, that was not super new to me, but firearms were very new to me. If you're not brought up with them and kind of in this culture of hunting, it's very kind of foreign and very scary. So it was really kind of a confrontation of fears for me to start hunting with a real gun. And my grandpa's shotgun was the first real gun that I had and was given. I think there is a really great sense of empowerment in knowing how to use a firearm. And it took me many years to be really comfortable, kind of have worked my way up. So there's this really great process. And I think it ties into feminism in just being kind of almost back to the being able to take care of yourself. There's a big difference of walking through the woods to get to a blind or something in the dark, 4 a.m. with a firearm and then without one. I don't know. Feminism is this, I think also it's being taken seriously of like, you know, there's so many men who grew up hunting. And then there's so many women whose fathers hunted and grandfathers hunted, but they weren't really taken hunting, you know, because it was kind of something, well, women, you know, girls weren't expected to want to do, or, you know, it was dirty or it was cold. And so I think there's some sort of satisfaction in dispelling notions of what gender should do what.
Pursuing what you personally want to do.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, hunting, you really don't shy away in your essay from talking about the bloody details of hunting and of the experience of being close to death in a way that most people aren't every day. You also write that you remember how it feels to hold a heart in your hand, which sounds pretty intense. And I was wondering, how does it feel to hold a heart in your hand?
Intense would be the right word. It really has, and I kind of think about this every time I am skinny or gutting anything, is just how close life is to death at every moment. And I think hunting has really kind of made that so real. You're running and then you're not. And how close, even just as soon as you get the skin off something, all of a sudden it's like your brain recognizes it, how thin the line is there. So I think it's made me a lot less scared of my own death, because you just almost see it as cycles, seeing it and being a part of it. I think there's I always have great respect for holding a heart in my hand. Like, that's a big deal. And we always, make as much use as we can out of every animal. It really makes death almost a just a normal thing, that you've seen it, you know, kind of maybe what you would look like when you're dying. Like, it is a very self-reflective thing, because you can't not look directly at it. So I think it really has helped me just make peace with death.
Wow. There's no substitute for lived experience, right? It's one thing to have an intellectual concept of death and to know that you'll die, and it's another thing to really experience it.
Yeah. Kind of almost this humbling, we all kind of look the same on the inside when everything's, stripped away. It puts you in your place, I guess, a little bit.
Which feels good sometimes as a human who often doesn't really know what their place is.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
I don't know if you've read, Brian Doyle has this amazing essay where he talks about the heart sizes of different animals, from the worm and the hummingbird, which the heart is as big as the eraser on a pencil, to the biggest of a blue whale, where a child could walk without bending through the passageways between the four chambers of the heart. It's an amazing essay.
I have not read that. I'm going to look that up now.
Wow. Well, thanks for being willing to share those details. I know that can be a little intense, but I think it's really meaningful.
I'm very happy to. Yeah.
I'm curious as well. I notice, which of course happens in most essays, this interesting focus on appearances throughout Solo. You talk, for example, about the beautiful light brown that on women shows gray first and fastest. You talked about your sister's t-shirt with dangerous curves ahead. You talked about the dullness of a diamond ring on someone's hand. And I was just wondering, it seemed there was some connection between the pictures that you chose to describe and also the way that they relate to gender and maybe your own experience. And I was just wondering if there's something at play in these descriptions and the choices of these appearances beyond the writerly desire or even obligation to describe.
Like you said, there's always this kind of, you're writing, there is an obligation to describe things. But I think those things have that connection, because I have always, it's always hard to know where things are coming from when you're writing exactly. Some things are very well thought out choices, and then sometimes things just come out. And I think those things were maybe a mixture of the two, probably stemming from growing up. I was I've always been just a real tomboy. And just, I remember I would cry if my mom would make me wear a dress to church. And like, it was just, when I remember my mom taking me to buy my first bra, and I was just bawling because I didn't want to grow up. And I felt like I was losing this kind of androgyny that I had always almost, I think not consciously when I was a kid, but that I had always treasured of being, you know, I was just a kid. I wasn't a girl, and I didn't want to be a woman for sure. I just kind of wanted to be that flat-chested little kid riding her bike around.
I had a similar experience and have a lot of friends too who have had similar experiences as girls and as women, where there is this sense of knowing what role might be waiting for you and not necessarily wanting to embody it.
Yes, yes. And I think that was most all of it, is I saw kind of womanhood is not this, oh, I can be an adult and I can still go have an adventure and I can be more independent. And it was kind of this womanhood was, well, you're going to be, you know, tied down. There are these just like, roles that I saw women around me fulfilling that I didn't think I wanted to fill. So I think that was a lot of what was tying into looks, was kind of, I've always had this really difficult relationship with looks. And kind of never wanting to fit in, but then also wanting to not at the same time, you know, and kind of that constant clash of kind of, I want to embrace looking nice and doing these, I don't know what you would consider like kind of traditional feminine things. But then at the same time, like I've just never been able to do it. So I've kind of always had this contentious relationship. So I think a lot of stuff like that, but diamond rings or the kind of just the appearance descriptions probably tie back to that, because it's something that I've thought about a lot in life.
Sounds like writing for you is kind of a way to process your experiences. I know you talked about some things are purposeful that you write, some things just come out. Would you say that that's accurate, or what role does writing play in your life?
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate description. I think it is a way to process things or to just make sense of things. A lot of kind of this essay was, I think, me trying to think about why it mattered to me that I had done this by myself, you know, because I remember that day I was just kind of like wanted to get out. And so I was going to go do this. But it wasn't until afterwards that I was like, well, why did this matter to me that I did this solo? And so I think it is a way of whittling down to the heart of my motivation in life.
And then you also make the decision to share your writing. What does that mean to you, or why share your work?
That's a good question. And it's actually one I think about a lot. A lot of writers grew up journaling, and I was always terrible about keeping a journal. I would always try and I would never be able to do it. And so I think there is a feeling of, even if something that I write never gets published anywhere, if I'm writing with that intent, it makes it feel like it has a little bit more purpose to share writing. And I think possibly it goes back to something of, I have always been a reader and have been helped out in so many ways in life by things I have read and by people really writing kind of raw, honest things. And so maybe it's just me feeling like I want to do that as well. Here are raw, honest things from my life that I'm trying to work through. But I do think there is like a view change if you're writing for just something that you know will never be seen by anyone else, or if you're writing in the hopes that someone else will see it. And I think it imbibes it with a little bit more intent, or maybe a little bit more thought.
Maybe a different focus too on connecting, even if you never know who you've touched, but providing some potential for support or growth or solace or inspiration for others.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely did that with Solo and provided potential for connection, for inspiration, for reflection. And I really appreciate it. Really appreciate you sharing with us.
This was really enjoyable.
I really enjoyed it too. Thank you for making the time.
I was glad to. Thank you so much for asking me on.
I'd like to bring another unique voice into the conversation. In the following reading, Ever Jones offers their perspective in a poem from the collection Night Songs.
In this new night, pronouns unbecome the body. Letters shake loose their coats into ravens, slanting syntax under feathers. Pull each system from yourself. Noxious weeds strangling the cedar, punctuations, teeth sunk in the ground, and unwind the human gaze, levering gravity into supremacy. When Goddess Diamond picks up the letters in the new sunrise, see a prism of curves, each serif a hooking talon, every comma a new way to feel rain.
We'll finish with a poem that lingers, this one by Michael Wasson. It's worth heading to terrain.org to see this poem on the page as well. I'll leave it up to you to find out why.
This is Michael Wasson reading Landscape with Visual History Centuries Later. I am not here to conquer this field of gluch, 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 chatat, iska, hlap, hlap, himpa, buhuhuch. The sound of clouds torn in the hands, like butterflies gone, butterflies in the mouth, a landscape after a light snowfall. Clouds torn like in the mouth, a landscape.
You can read and engage with each artist's work at terrain.org. Thanks for listening and for being a part of our community. We'd love to hear from you and hope you join us for another episode of Soundscapes. Until then, here's to being more than alone, and to each one of you.